And good afternoon, Juno. This is Ben Brown, and you're listening to A Juno Afternoon this Monday, the 22nd of June, and I'm going to be your host this afternoon, and indeed most Monday afternoons for the rest of the summer, about which I'm very excited. So we've got a good program of people to talk with and learn some things from this afternoon. We're going to start off with our new series, Words 101, and our first guest in that series will very appropriately be Jim Hale, who will talk about good and bad writing. Next, we'll hear from Greg Chaney, the CBJ Lands and Resources Manager, who will have an update on recent land activities, followed by Russ Cohen, who's going to talk about his new book about the Japanese invasion of the United States by balloon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. When an eagle loses a feather in Alaska, it may end up in another state for use by Native Americans. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, a federal program works with tribes, raptor centers, and wildlife officials.
One, two, three.
There we go.
A bald eagle is released into the wild at the Alaska Raptor Center in Sitka. It's one of hundreds treated for injuries, disease, or malnourishment at centers around the state. But the story doesn't end with the flight. That's because the Raptor Center collects feathers rehabilitating birds lose while molting. Staffer Jennifer Cedarleaf also collects plumage from eagles that can't be released into the wild.
Our education birds that are here year-round, when they drop their feathers, we collect those, and they all just get saved up, and then I can send them down there.
There is the National Eagle Repository, run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service near Denver, Colorado. It distributes feathers and carcasses to Alaska Natives and American Indians who can't find them locally.
So it could be for folks that are in a powwow, dancing, fans, bustles.
Joseph Early is the Native American liaison for the Wildlife Service's Southwest Region and a Laguna Pueblo member.
We have some of our tribes that use them for our very sacred ceremonies, naming ceremonies, birth ceremonies, sometimes for funerals, graduations.
The repository reports Alaska provided about 10% of the feathers, parts, or carcasses it collected last year. But tribal members here took only 0.5% of what was distributed. For National Native News, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
For the first time in more than 30 years, the Navajo Nation Zoo is not exhibiting snakes. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, zoo officials made the decision to relocate them due to the beliefs by many Navajos about the reptiles.
Snakes are seen as bad omens in traditional Navajo culture, and some tribal members even refuse to breathe the same air as the reptiles. David McKessick is a zoologist and the manager of the Navajo Nation Zoo.
We realize that, you know, this is not just a simple fear of snakes. This goes all the way up to a cultural issue.
The presence of a rattlesnake and two gopher snakes at the zoo's Discovery Center caused many people to skip the exhibits altogether. McKessick says some parents and teachers had stopped allowing school children to visit the facility.
You know, it's kind of a logical decision. If we have an animal that prevents people from enjoying the rest of the building, then, you know, the question is why have it here? And one of the easiest things that we can do about it is to rehome them.
The snakes were initially brought to the zoo as rescue animals. They've been relocated to facilities in Utah and New York. An endangered black-footed ferret will move into the Navajo Zoo's former snake enclosure after it's renovated. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Office of U.S. Attorney for Arizona says a multi-agency drug investigation has resulted in multiple arrests on the Fort Apache Reservation. A federal grand jury has indicted 24 individuals. 18 have now been arrested. Officials say the effort is to disrupt drug trafficking and protect public safety on the Arizona reservation. Charges include drug trafficking, firearms violations, assault, and domestic violence offenses. Events were held across Canada over the weekend to celebrate the culture and achievements of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. National Aboriginal Day is held annually on June 21st. This year's celebration comes after a recent report on Indian residential schools. A commission found that what happened to Native children in the mid-1800s to the late 1900s was cultural genocide. Thousands of students were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. First Nations leaders are urging the Canadian government to act on the report, which includes 94 recommendations. Some events on the holiday weekend included a space for people to talk, reflect, and work on healing. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Supported by the National Indian Education Association, an inclusive Native organization representing Native students, educators, families, communities, and tribes. Membership registration available at niea.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And we're back here on a Juneau afternoon. Ben Brown here. Really quick look at the weather this afternoon. The forecast from our friends at the National Weather Service is for partly cloudy conditions and a high from 66 to 73 this afternoon, and west wind to 10 miles per hour. And tonight, mostly cloudy, and we'll have a fresh look at the weather when we get to the end of the hour. So before we speak with our first guest today, I wanted to take a quick look, figuratively and literally, out the window at Nimbus, the controversial sculpture, which has just been returned to its permanent home in front of downtown Juneau State Museum. And on Saturday, if you were watching, construction workers placed the green 16-foot, 5-ton abstract sculpture on a new concrete pad in front of the relatively newly named Father Andrew P. Kasheverov State Library, Archives, and Museum. Canadian sculptor Robert Murray was in Juneau at the weekend to oversee the placement of Nimbus on the museum grounds and inspect restoration work that is still underway. Nimbus was damaged when it was removed from its original site at the Diamond Courthouse Plaza in the mid-'80s. Murray's sculptures have been compared to the large abstract mobiles produced by Alexander Calder, but his pieces are called stabiles because they're usually rooted to their landscape. So KTOO's Matt Miller was able to talk to Mr. Murray about overcoming some of the preconceived notions and finding meaning in the piece Nimbus.
A lot of Juneau people, when they look at this, they say, well, what's it supposed to be? What does it mean? What would be your response? Or would you have a response, or would you just kind of throw up your hands and walk away?
You mentioned Alexander Calder. I was at Lincoln Center in New York when one of Calder's pieces was being installed years ago, and there was a woman who was an interviewer on one of the television stations, and she came up to Calder, and who was quite a tall man with a big shock of white hair, and she held the mic up to him and said, well, now, Mr. Calder, I know it's not cool to ask an artist what their sculpture means, but, you know, I know my public would like to know. What does this sculpture mean? What does it represent? Calder leaned over and said, it doesn't mean a damn thing. And I thought, I hope someday I develop that much confidence in what I'm doing that I can say that. Because it's not that there's anything wrong with the question, it's just not the appropriate question for what people are supposed to take from the work, in the sense that all of the information is in the sculpture itself, and it's by walking around and looking at it and reacting to it that you see what's obviously there and why it takes the form that it does. So that saying it's like something else, in other words, doesn't get you any closer to what the meaning is. It's not that it doesn't have content, or there isn't meaning implied here. It's just that it's not like something else. You know, if somebody thinks it looks like a duck, I'm in real trouble.
Would it be appropriate, though, to say, okay, this sculpture is now no longer just a piece of abstract art in its simple physical form, but it also is perhaps maybe even performance art or Alaska historical art or even political art. And I'm kind of referring to that era when it was removed from the Diamond Courthouse. Could it also act as kind of a symbol for that whole debate in regards to public funding for art and politicians getting involved?
Well, yes to all of those, all of the above. I think the work, hopefully, after a period of time, and that was a little bit what was wrong with the controversy, is it got a little bit out of hand before the piece had hardly had a chance to acclimatize, for people to acclimatize themselves to the sculpture, let's say. That's why one of the things that was changed with the NEA's policy while they were still in business was that they then insisted on a work that they helped fund staying in place for a minimum of 10 years. And that helps people kind of get over the initial reaction to the work, which when it's negative, it's nearly always the fault of people asking. Well, I was telling Robert earlier that when we were working on the sculpture here, there was a little lady walking by with two big brown bags full of groceries, and a reporter thrust a microphone in her face and said, and we could hear all this, "What do you think about this big ugly green thing?" And she said, "Oh, I think it's a big ugly green thing." And then she said, "Wait a minute, my name is Green." And that, the next day in the Juno Empire, there was a picture of this woman with the two bags of groceries, and it said, "Mrs. So-and-so thinks this is a big ugly green thing." Well, you know, that kind of, that's like street theater. It doesn't really have too much to do with the sculpture. But unfortunately, that's part of the nature of the game. I mean, you can almost always expect a certain amount of that to go on. Trouble is, it can sometimes prejudice people against being objective and looking at what they're doing. I installed a piece of sculpture in a rather interesting coastal location in Nova Scotia last summer. And a woman came up to me and said, "Now, I realize this is abstract sculpture and I'm not supposed to ask this, but, you know, what's this based on?" And I thought, well, that was a somewhat gentler question. So I said to her, "Go and walk around the sculpture and keep walking around it and look at how the two basic elements of the sculpture relate to each other and see how varied it is. And see what's in balance, what's very sturdy looking, what's very broad, look and see what's very linear to it." And afterwards she came back and sort of burst into another conversation I was having with someone else and said, I get it. Well, we never decided what she got, and I'm not sure there was anything to get. But the point of it is that she was looking and doing the right thing. She was walking in and around the work and reacting to it, and not having preconceived ideas about it. There was looking like a duck.
There was one very prominent artist, she's passed away now, but one very prominent artist here in Juneau who, after the first go-around, when it was removed from the Diamond Courthouse, basically called it a piece of junk. And she, I guess she pretty much called it a bum piece of work, and I think she was kind of harshing on the Lippincotts and that sort of thing. Any sort of reaction to that sort of thing, or any sort of defense of the manufacturers?
Well, what you can't expect is that people will be aware of the whole history of contemporary sculpture. I mean, it's come a long way from the days of statuary and, you know, men on horseback, and usually who didn't look like the guy they depicted, nor did the horse look like the horse that they rode, but that's okay. You know, that kind of monumental, what I call park sculpture, that kind of statuary, is something that people were used to seeing in outdoor situations in relationship to parks or architecture and so on. But a lot has happened, not only in sculpture, but in all the other arts, including theater, performance art, painting, and so on. And you can't necessarily expect people who are not passionate and involved in those areas to keep up to speed. The difficulty with putting these works out into the public domain is that you, and outside of a museum, let's say, is that people go to a museum expecting to see the latest work, to see where, how work has evolved, painting, sculpture, and so on has evolved. When they're suddenly confronted with something that seems terribly contemporary and foreign to them, you know, they just don't have the background to understand the difference. They do have the ability, however, to appreciate what's in front of them, if they just don't carry all this baggage, if it isn't coloring their point of view.
You seem awfully good-natured and good-humored about the trials and tribulations that this piece has gone through over the last 38 years.
Well, if I'd had any idea that you were going to be I was going to be as provocative as I was, I might have turned to another line of work. I don't know. but it seems to come with the territory. But I think it's the reason I mentioned, is that when you go out on the street and you can't necessarily rely on a large number of people knowing the changes that have taken place in art since where they stopped thinking about it, you know, where their last art history class in grade six was, then you know that it's going to be provocative. As a matter of fact, I kind of count on it. I mean, if you're not rattling people's cages a little bit, then you're failing. You know, if suddenly the work is just welcome and openly embraced, then that leads me to think I'm doing something wrong here. You know, I'm still back in the 19th century.
Oh, it's an interesting interview with KTOO's Matt Miller and the sculptor behind Nimbus. So if you haven't seen Nimbus in its new home in front of the Chevroff Museum, come on down and take a look at that. It's all about 16 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juno Afternoon. And our first guest today is Jim Hale. He's the first person to appear in our new series this summer, Words 101. And the question I have for you, Jim, other than how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing fine, Ben. Thanks.
Excellent. What makes for good writing? You know, many listeners probably have read your columns in The Empire. Some of them may have been fortunate enough to take your writing course like I have. But for those who haven't been blessed in either way, tell us on the radio right now, what makes for good writing?
Well, first of all, it depends on what kind of writing you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We expect that in a novel or a poem, good writing will be the writing that asks you to pay attention to the music of the words themselves, all the poetry of the language. And so you slow down. You read slowly, you read carefully, you read joyfully. Not so much with an environmental impact statement. then we just want, the readers just want to get through it as quickly as possible, get the information they need. And so we have to write in a different way that doesn't ask readers to slow down, but allows that they're going to be tempted to skim.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to put the information up front, as easy for them to grasp as possible, and get on to the next sentence. So different kinds of writing.
And do you think that people, before they've been educated, have a good sense of knowing what kind of writing they're doing, or is that maybe one of the pitfalls that's pretty common? You think you're writing for one audience, but you're not. You're writing for a different audience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think readers generally have unconscious expectations about where to find stuff in a sentence. So if you're reading the newspaper, you've got certain expectations about, you know, length of sentences, length of paragraphs, and those are designed to help you as the reader of the newspaper. And the same with some kind of bureaucratic writing, whether it's an analytical statement or a report of some kind. Readers know where to find the important information, so it's important for us as writers to put the information where they expect to find it.
Now, most people probably don't have a lot of formal instruction in writing once they leave high school, maybe college, you know, taking an English class at college. At that point, you're supposed to know what you're doing and put those skills to use when you're writing papers and other substantive subjects. So how do people keep how do they improve their abilities if they're not as good as they should be, and how do they keep them fresh?
Well, that's the problem for teachers.
Mm-hmm.
How do we I think we need to – the great thing – is that we all start in a good place. We all know how to communicate using language. We speak almost virtually every day of our lives. We're listening, we're speaking, we're talking. Something comes in front of us, gets in our way when we start writing, gets in our way of just using language the way we know how to very well. So I think a large part of the teacher's job is to break down those barriers, to let writers know that it's okay to use the language as well as you know how to use it when we're talking.
Uh-huh.
So that's important. It's a hard barrier to break through. But we do know how to use language. We know how to use language very well.
So if a person wants to write something, is a little insecure about how good the quality of the product is going to be, can they take it back a step and say, well, how would I say it?
That's always my first advice.
Uh-huh.
If you're having trouble writing something, trouble explaining something, how would you explain it to your mother?
Mm-hmm.
How would you explain it to your best friend? Partners are great for that. Just grab them, sit them down, say, listen to this. Does this sound like something? Or just try to explain it and use it, you know, in speech, and listen to yourself, and then go and try and put that down on paper.
And in terms of putting it down on paper, that kind of segues into my next point. We almost all use keyboards, you know, in our typewriting when
yes.
we write things these days. Is there any advantage, at least for those of us who were taught to write with a pen or a pencil? You know, I guess everyone still knows how to do that, but I understand cursive has been banished from the grammar school curriculum. Is that perhaps something that some people might feel more comfortable doing, to write with, you know, longhand and not use a typewriter? Does that make any difference in the way the words flow onto the page or on the screen?
Well, I think ironically, in making it easier for us to revise our sentences, computers have made us worse writers.
Mm-hmm.
When you sit down at the typewriter, you took more time to compose your sentence, to make sure that sentence was as much as possible the sentence you wanted it to be. Because if not, you're going to have to retype the whole page, or like me, become Picasso with the whiteout.
Mm-hmm.
Computers, because it's so easy to revise, we type the line out any way we can onto the screen, and we say, okay, well, I'll move on. I'll come back when I'm done and revise this sentence. And you go from one sentence to another sentence like that, and as Robert Frost says, way leads on to way, and you never get back to that sentence not revised.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get done with the document, the boss is screaming for it, you know, and so you hit send and off it goes.
Right. Well, I know, I do write a column for The Empire as well, and whenever any sort of writing task you have to get done, this was true when I was an attorney, with a word processor, it almost feels like the more I can just get down into this document,
right,
then I'm going to be fine. But that can actually create a lot of problems, is what I hear you saying, because you're creating stuff that's not going to be subject to very good revision.
Exactly. We put so much more emphasis on composition in the first place when we're writing. We didn't write a sentence without revising it, you know, five times, or as we went along. I don't write so much as I revise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just part of the process.
Now, you mentioned earlier partners and having them take a look at something. How often are you asked to proofread other people's work, and do you mind doing it? And do you really feel like when you ask other people to proofread your work that they're really reading it, or are they just saying, this looks great?
Oh, well, okay. Well, the first question, my main job, I'm a technical editor for NOAA Fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm editing other people's work all day long. I'm looking at their work and trying to help them write more clearly. In fact, we're just in the process of producing a substantial style guide to help writers. So I'm always, and as an editor, I'm sure you know, one of your big jobs is to be diplomatic. You know, everyone likes to be proud of their work, and they send you a document and need substantial work, and you have to really learn to be diplomatic to help people become better writers. My own family don't feel that way. my wife Michelle, my twin sister Judy, my son Harry, they're my home editorial board. They read virtually everything I write, and they mortify me with their comments. And they're great. I need that. They make me a better writer.
Well, they probably think that you're a professional writer, so that you have a very thick skin and you can handle really, really harsh, unvarnished criticism. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and attribute those beneficial motives to them.
My wife, yes. My sister, no.
Very good. Well, what lately in your career as a professional writer has been particularly rewarding for you, if anything?
Oh, yes. I think the main thing has been about a year and a half ago, I started teaching a writing course as a volunteer at Lemon Creek Correctional Center.
Uh-huh.
And it's an incredibly rewarding experience. The guys that have been there, been with me since I started. I call them my repeat offenders. They keep coming back, and you can tell they want this information. They want to know how to write better. They want to have a voice. And I've been working with Paul McCartney, the educational coordinator out there,
mm-hmm.
and it's just been a very rewarding experience for me personally. Also, writing the column for The Empire has been great because I didn't think I had that much to say, but you write one essay and it generates more ideas, and so it's been I've been able to really clarify some of my own ideas about writing.
Uh-huh.
And they're sort of further off from the mainstream than I would have imagined.
Well, I think it's a valuable message that you impart to people. You know, I'm one of those people who cannot send a text message unless everything's spelled correctly, capitalized correctly. There's two spaces between the end of one sentence and the beginning of the next one, and I have to use correct punctuation. I do use the ellipsis a little too much.
Okay.
You know, I end, which is three dots, for those of you listening who may not know, an ellipsis is, you know, a punctuation device to let you know that something is trailing, which is often the thing when you're sending a text message.
Right, right.
What do you think about the... the apparent demise of written English because of technology? You think it's as bad as some of the pundits have said, or do you think we're going to survive?
I think we'll survive. The interesting thing is, in one of Plato's dialogues, he has Socrates complaining about the new technology, how it's going to ruin our ability to think clearly, and that new technology was writing.
Right.
Socrates distrusted writing because he saw knowledge as something that emerges out of conversation between two people.
Uh-huh.
And writing just, it was like a photograph of people talking. It couldn't really respond to you. It couldn't engage in that kind of conversation. I think Socrates' fears have not been substantiated.
Uh-huh.
You know, we've come quite a long way, and I think the new technology, we'll learn how to deal with it. I think there's a good possibility it'll make us even better communicators in the end.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the more we write and the more facility we have in the technology to help us write, maybe it'll help us write more like we speak. Now look at texts and uh-huh. tweets and whatever. People are writing more the way they speak. They're getting more accustomed to that.
Uh-huh.
We're communicating more in writing now than ever before, really.
And it's not really a generational thing. I know I actually was going through deleting old text conversations.
Sure.
And some of the ones with the most annoying text, you know, text speak with numbers for words and everything come from people many, many years my senior that I never would have thought would be so addicted to that kind of text writing style. I don't really know what it's called.
I don't either, but when you hear a 70-year-old say, WTF,
right.
You know something's happened.
yes, you do. And it's probably a good thing. But I guess to go back to Socrates, you know, what he was afraid of is that he wanted perfect, he wanted things to be perfect, and not realizing that the benefits, the good that could come from reducing things to writing, you know, is a double-edged sword.
Yes.
So yes, everything wasn't going to be fresh and Socratic in the moment, but things were preserved.
Yes.
And the benefit there, obviously, it changed the world.
Right.
And so I think we need to be open-minded to the benefits of this new technology as well as the potential pitfalls.
Absolutely. I think it's history is littered with conservative thinkers who thought the new technology was going to, you know, send us into a tailspin.
Absolutely.
And they never did.
And, of course, I'm not on FaceTwit, so, you know, I can't really be – I can't pretend to be too much part of the new technology.
Facebook, I call it.
There you go, Facebook. Do you have any other fun writing projects coming up? You're going to continue doing your great volunteer work out at Lemon Creek, but anything else on the horizon for you right now writing-wise? You going to be teaching some more of your classes here in town?
I hope so. I've got plans to do some more writing classes here in the fall. Teaching part-time out at the university. I'll continue writing the column for the Capital City Weekly.
Uh-huh.
I've got a great editor out of there, Amy Fletcher. She's done a wonderful job with the Capital City Weekly.
That paper actually has become a little more invigorated in the past couple of years.
It's wonderful now. People are reading.
Yes, yes. Well, that's great. And so I hope that you will stay tuned. You know, this was Jeff Brown's idea to have a Words 101 segment here on a Juneau afternoon. And I know he's got some great ideas for other folks to come up. So if you, as the first guest and as quite a wordsmith and an expert in writing, have any suggestions, I'm sure Jeff would love to hear those if he hasn't filled up all the spots. And for those of you listening, don't be afraid to write when you can call. Maybe send a text message that's correctly spelled and punctuated instead, right?
That's right. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, you, Jim.
Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 22nd of June, 2015. It was on this day, 1944, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed into law the GI Bill of Rights, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act. Economists were predicting a post-war depression. They didn't like the idea of 9 million unemployed veterans wandering the country, and so the GI Bill guaranteed unemployment benefits for a year, and also threw in the idea that veterans could get money to go to college, although even the supporters of the bill didn't think that many would really want to go. But about 1 million veterans applied for the money. They crowded the campuses. Professors at the time said the veterans were the most serious students they had ever seen. Before World War II, only 53,000 Americans held college degrees. By 1950, there were 500,000. It's the birthday of the novelist Eric Maria Remarque, whose novel All Quiet on the Western Front came out in 1929. He'd been drafted into the army at the age of 18, suffered severe injuries fighting on the Western Front. The book was banned by the Nazi regime in Germany. Remarque came to this country and wrote 9 more novels. It's the birthday of Billy Wilder, born in Austria, 1906, came to this country in the 1930s, got a job writing scripts for Fox, worked his way up the ladder, ended up producing and directing some great movies, Double Indemnity, 7-Year Itch, Some Like It Hot, and The Apartment. Billy Wilder, who said, an actor entering through the door, you've got nothing, but if he enters through the window, you've got a situation. And it's the birthday of Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, born in Oklahoma City, 1949. Her mother worked at Sears. Her dad was a janitor. She graduated high school at 16, got a scholarship to George Washington University, married a NASA engineer, enrolled in law school at Rutgers, got interested in bankruptcy law, and became the advisor for the National Bankruptcy Review Commission, from which she developed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Here's a poem for today by Diane Lockwood entitled Linguini. It was always linguini between us, linguini with white sauce or red sauce, sauce with basil snatched from the garden, oregano rubbed between our palms, a single bay leaf adrift amidst plum tomatoes. Linguini with meatballs, sausage, a side of bracioli. Like lovers trying positions, we enjoyed it every way we could. Artichokes, mushrooms, little neck clams, mussels and calamari, linguini twining and braiding us each to each. Linguini knew of the kisses, the smooches, the molte bacce. It was never spaghetti between us, not capellini, not farfalla, vermicelli, pappardelle, fettuccine, percitelli, or even tagliarini. Linguini, we stabbed, pitched, and twirled on forks, spun round and round on silver spoons, long, smooth, and always al dente. In dark trattorias, we broke crusty panera, toasted each other, la dolce vita, and sipped amarone, wrapped ourselves and linguini, briskly boiled, lightly oiled, salted and lavished with sauce. Bellissimo paradiso, belle gente. Linguini witnessed our slurping, pulling and sucking, our unraveling and raveling, chins glistening, napkins tucked like bibs and collars. Linguini stuck to lips, hips and bellies, cheeks flecked with formaggio, parmesan, romano, and shaved pecorino. Strands of linguini flung around our necks like 2 fine silk scarves. A poem by Diane Lockwood, Linguini, from her collection What Feeds Us, published by Wind Publications, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com, and by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
And you are listening to A Juno Afternoon. It's about 33 minutes after the hour. I'm your host, Ben Brown, and our guest for this segment is going to be is Greg Cheney, the CBJ Lands and Resources Manager. So welcome, Greg, here to KTOO.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and I think the topic we'd like to discuss with you is an update on Juno lands. Do we have any more of it, and if so, what can we do with the
well,
newly acquired land?
The city has a lot of land. The problem we have is that most of it that's not in park status is off the road system, so we've got thousands of acres, but it's up and behind everybody else, so it's hard to get to. But the one exception to that is our Lena subdivision, which we've been working on for many years, and we're having another land sale right now. It's live, and we're going to be taking bids until 4:30 on Friday, so anyone who's interested in bidding on that, now's the time. The great thing about this particular offering is we have 6 lots. They're big. They're each about an acre. And the prices are pretty reasonable. So last time we had the our last, just a second here, the last subdivision that we did and the last offering we did, the people that I talked to said, I'm sorry I didn't bid because I thought people were going to be bidding so high I didn't put a bid in. And I said, well, you could have put the minimum bid in. There's no risk there.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't want to spend a lot, put in the minimum. Maybe nobody else will bid. And that happened on a couple lots. We didn't get any bids. So I'd encourage people to come in, put in what you think you want. If you really want it, bid as much as you think you can afford. And if you just are interested, just put in the minimum bid. You never know.
And so, and there's six lots, and those are the Lena subdivision, and they have
Correct.
To come into the land's office in person to do that.
Yeah, they have to drop off an actual bid, and it's actually the purchasing office where you would drop it off. But we're a pretty friendly place. If you come down to City Hall and you don't know where the purchasing office is, we'll direct you there. But you need to get there by 4:30 on Friday because that's when bids close, and we're pretty that's a pretty firm deadline.
And in prior land sales that the city and borough of Juneau has done, has there ever been a problem not getting any bids and pieces that just don't go, they go unsold because no one's expressed
well,
any interest?
Yeah, a few years ago we had a land sale and they put out several lots and the demand wasn't there. So some sold and some didn't. So we just held on to the ones that didn't and now that's what we're offering again. So, you know, times have changed. People are feeling a little more optimistic. So
And again, if you want to hedge your bets, put in the minimum bid, and you might be the lucky winner.
You might get it. So, there's nothing wrong with doing that.
Excellent. What else is going on with lands here in CDJ?
Well, you know, there's a lot. We're going to be pulling out a revision of the lands management plan here in about a year. About a month. Last time we did this was 1999. And so it's a long time coming. When you read back through the old land management plan, a lot of the issues are the same, but a lot of things have shifted or moved on since then. So it's really time for an update. And so I've been with the department for 2 years, and we've been encouraged to get something new out the door. So we're working on it feverishly even today, and hopefully in a couple of maybe a month or two, depending on details, we'll get the maps. There's a lot of, it's a big atlas as well as a lot of detailed information and then broad policies. So that'll hit the streets in a month or two, and I just want people to kind of be looking for it.
And when that happens, is there sort of a public process after that, some community meetings, and then it goes back to the assembly for adoption?
You said it all, right. Yeah. First of all, we'll probably take it to the Lands Committee for them to look at, get any feedback from them. Whatever we get from them, we'll work on that and then take it out to the public. Have a couple, two or three, whatever the demand is, public meetings, and then ultimately up to the Assembly for approval and the Planning Commission. I forgot to mention that.
Of course. And so this, just for folks listening who don't understand what's going to be in the land plan versus, say, the downtown, the waterfront plan, are there some crossover issues so people who are really interested in the Seawalk project would want to follow this as well?
Yes, and not so much. And, you know, if you're really focused on one little issue, lands plan might have one or two pages on that issue. So it's good to check in to make sure it's the same as what you're thinking, or if it isn't, that you'd comment on that. But it's a big, broad document. It covers all of our property, and we go from Eldred Rock down to Taku Inlet. So there's a lot of property in that big area that we have. Most of it's clustered along the road system, but oddly enough, it's just off the road system. So there's usually a broad band of private property, and then our city property behind that. So one of my big challenges is trying to find access to our lots.
Right.
So it lists the properties that we're going to develop. It also lists the parks that we're going to keep in park status. So if you've got a particular park you're interested in, you might want to check it out. But we're not planning on divesting of much parkland. That's pretty unlikely. So, but there are other park properties that we have that we might look at developing.
The revenues that are generated from these land sales, do those get earmarked for any specific purpose, or does that just go into the general fund for the assembly to spend at its discretion?
No, that's an excellent question. Actually, the property that we sell, the proceeds from that goes into the lands fund, and the lands fund is intended to be used for developing more property. So it's like a little bit like a perpetual motion machine. You take money from development, put it into the fund, use that money in the fund to develop more property. So we're slowly putting our property out on the market. The one thing we have to be careful of is not to flood the market because we don't want to, artificially change the land market in Juneau. But we also do want to make sure there's a consistent supply. We don't want our community to kind of become land bound and not have anywhere to grow.
Uh-huh.
So it's
uh-huh.
a nice balancing act we do.
Excellent. What other issues are before you as the Lands and Resources Manager for the City of Borough?
Okay, a little more immediate and maybe smaller scale. We're going to be rolling out, assuming the Assembly approves it, a mobile home down payment assistance program. And that's trying to lubricate the mobile home market right now. People who own mobile homes have a hard time selling them, and the people who want to buy have a hard time getting into them. And it's kind of the introductory rung into home ownership. And there aren't many banks that are loaning on those in Juneau, so there's a pretty small market for people who want to try to get a mortgage. But what we're proposing is to put up money as to go with your down payment. So it would be a match. It would be a low-interest loan, so you'd still have to pay it back. But it would be up to $10,000 that would match with your money to go towards a down payment for a mobile home. And the exciting thing about that is a lot of people who are trying to get into mobile homes are having a hard time with the down payment. This would allow them to get in. It also gets the other people who own, maybe they get to step up into another type of home that they're desiring. And so the hope is that by lubricating the market in the lower kind of level of home ownership, more people will be able to own and homes, build equity, all that good stuff.
And I'm not really familiar with how many mobile home areas there are in Juneau. There's Cutoff Acres. There's that place in North Douglas. Mm-hmm. There's Schweitzer Creek. Yeah. I'm not really familiar with the ownership of land in those contexts. So do people purchase an undivided interest in the whole, or are they simply renting for the most part?
Yeah, basically they have space rent.
Okay.
So what you do is you're leasing the space, but you own the unit that sits on that space.
Mm-hmm.
So that's made financing difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if you own the property that the mobile home is on, it's easier to get a loan on it. But if it's in a mobile home park, which is what that I've been describing, that is harder to get financing. So this will help people get financing and hopefully make it a little easier for people to move up or move in.
But there are not really any condominium mobile home ownership arrangements in Juneau.
I'm not aware of them. All the ones I know of have a single owner that owns
all of
the land.
And I don't even know, if under the Uniform Horizontal Property Ownership Statute in Alaska, if that's possible. Just as someone who lives in a condominium myself, it occurred to me that's that you have more of an interest if you actually own a piece of the property underneath the mobile home.
That's true. But I'm not aware of any that are like that. Yeah, I think it's more of a traditional model, and there aren't very many new ones. You know, most of the mobile home parks we have came around in the 70s and maybe the 80s, but that was it. You know, we've had one or two since then.
And now the funds for this assistance program, are they just coming from CBJ Coppice, or is there something from the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
Well, they're from the Affordable Housing Fund, which is a specific fund within the CBJ, but it's specifically designated for housing-related issues. And a lot of that seed money for that originally came from state and federal grants. And it's a fund we try to keep whole by this is a loan program, for example. So you would pay it out, but then you would also get the money back eventually. So it's a fund that's part of the CBJ, but it's a specially designated fund.
All right, great. And are you planning to do, because I think one of the interesting things about what you just described is that sort of second tier, moving from, you know, a first-time homeowner may have owned a mobile home, been renting the land that it was on, wants to cash out on that investment. Are you going to be able to track how successful those people are in terms of buying their first standalone house or condominium?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I don't think we've really thought about that. We could look into that, though. It's pretty easy to track because these are, the lenders that lend will be, also involved in the next, usually they're involved in the next phase. So
very
interesting. That's a good point.
Absolutely. And what else is going on?
We got the Gatineau apartments for those folks who go by downtown. It's been a favorite topic.
Wait a minute. Did something happen at the Gatineau apartments? Did I miss? Was this recent? I'm sorry.
Well, there was a fire a couple of years ago, but who's counting? Anyway, it's been a while.
I believe it was the evening before the last presidential election.
Ah, well, thank you for that.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And so the reason that I'm bringing it up now is it does not appear that the owner is going to demolish the building. We have an agreement with them. If they're not able to do that, the city is going to step in and demolish. I don't know the exact legal structure around that, but I can say that we're moving forward. And tonight at the Lands Committee, we're going to be discussing using a specific fund, a CIP, Capital Improvement Project funding source that was going to be used for subdivisions. We're going to probably redirect that, at least for the time being, to try to remove the building from the site, and then we'll have a vacant lot for somebody to develop.
And that lot will still be owned by the current owners. The demolition costs they're going to have to pay for if the city does it on their behalf. So what's going to happen next? Once that's an empty lot, I think is what people want to know, someone could swoop in and buy it from the existing owners, or they could just have it sit there empty still, and that's not really going to make downtown better.
I don't want to really speculate too much on that. One way or another, the city is going to make sure that that lot is available for construction once the building is removed.
All right.
We don't want another thing like the pit, you know, where we have this big open spot for years.
But look how well that turned out in the end,
that's
Greg.
True,
you know,
that's
we had to
true.
Wait a little while, and now we've got the Sobolov Center.
Good things come to those who wait.
Excellent. Anything else you'd like to say to our listeners then this afternoon?
Well, there's one more thing that's kind of interesting. Is that we have an asphalt plant that is being proposed for the Lemon Creek area. That last time, we only have at this point, we only have one asphalt provider in town. It'd be nice to have some competition. But the proposers have asked for us to lease city property, so that will have to be approved by the assembly.
All right. So all these issues you've mentioned this afternoon will be considered by various committees of the CBJ Assembly.
You bet. There'll be
formal assembly action, and there'll be public process all through.
You bet. We're very open. So So if that's about it, then I'll just encourage people to look at the Lena land sale. It's on the city website, and you can look at the lots there and see if you're interested in bidding.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Greg, for coming in this afternoon. This is Greg Chaney, CBJ Lands and Resources Manager, and we look forward to seeing some of these lands get into better beneficial use in the very near future.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, now. I'm Ben Brown. This is a Juneau afternoon. It's about 13 minutes before the hour, and with me now is Ross Cohen, who has written a book and is going to be doing a book signing this weekend, and that book is called Fugo. This is a typo. I thought I saw it with a G somewhere else. So Fugo, tell us about Fugo, Ross.
Well, Fugo, F-U-G-O, is the code name for a weapon of war that was employed by the Japanese Imperial Army in World War II. And it's a balloon bomb. It's a large hydrogen balloon that the Japanese launched from mainland Japan in 1944 and 45. And the Japanese at that time had extensive knowledge of the jet stream, the high westerly winds of the upper atmosphere. Now, the name jet stream didn't actually come along until after the war. But the Japanese knew about these winds, and they knew that to launch one of these balloons in Japan, once it ascended to about 30, 40,000 feet, it would enter those wind currents, be carried across the Pacific Ocean, and arrive in North America in about 3 or 4 days. And so my book is about this very little-known campaign, this footnote to the Second World War, where the Japanese launched 9,000 of these balloons laden with explosives in the hopes of causing material damage in the United States.
And it was pretty late in the war when this strategy was undertaken?
It was, November of 1944 to April of 1945.
Okay, so was this a war tactic that had been used previously by other countries during the Second World War or earlier? Because the technology for hydrogen balloon would have existed in the First World War, I would think, when they were dirigibles and Zeppelins and all that.
I mean, the technology goes back to the Napoleonic Napoleonic Wars.
Okay.
And in fact, the use of balloons in wartime really goes back to the 18th century, mostly for espionage,
uh-huh.
for going up and looking at enemy maneuvers, that kind of thing. The use of ballooned explosives, that was relatively new. That had been done in the Russo-Japanese War, a few minor campaigns here and there. But this was by far the largest campaign to use that tactic.
And so how did you alight upon this as a topic for research and writing a book? Because it's very niche. It's very specific.
Yeah.
I know you've written a couple of other books. Were they similar to this?
No. This is a departure for me. You know, any historian or researcher out there will tell you that you're working on one project. You see a reference in the archives to something else. You start going down that trail, and before you know it, you've abandoned the first project, and now you're off on this rabbit hole. And that's what happened here. I was writing an article about the jet stream. This was about 10 or 12 years ago, and I saw a reference to the Japanese balloons of World War II, which at the time I had never heard of. I started doing some reading. I saw that there were a few articles and a couple books in the 1970s that had been written about this, but largely from a technical standpoint. And I knew that there had to be something more to the story. There had to be a personal story behind this campaign. You know what happened when Farmer John in uh-huh. Kansas had one of these things land in his wheat field, you know? And so I started doing some research, and before you know it, that article on the jet stream was abandoned. I've never finished it, but I went off and wrote a book about this.
And where did you go to do your research? I mean, it sounds like it was a little-known thing. I guess the real salient question, listeners may be interested, I certainly would like to know, did any of these things achieve their intended purpose and damage Americans or Canadians during the war effort?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. The Japanese launched 9,000 balloons over the course of that year in the war, but really only about 300, maybe 350 are confirmed as having arrived in North America. Of that number, a few started some minor wildfires, no real damage to speak of. Listeners, if they are aware of this story, they're probably aware of the one fatal incident involving these balloons. One came down in south central Oregon, and a Sunday school picnic. They were out in the woods doing some fishing. The children found a balloon that was on the ground. They didn't know what it was. They gathered around in a tight circle. One of the children picked it up. The bomb detonated, and it killed five children and their adult chaperone. Those are the only fatalities on the mainland United States as a result of enemy action during World War II.
Well,
so,
from that one balloon that actually made it over.
That was the only one, yeah.
So, of course, during wartime, there's not a lot of thought given to environmental sensitivity, certainly not back in 1944. But so a bunch of the rest of those just went into the ocean and did unpleasant things there.
Most went into the ocean. I mean, you can imagine the logistical challenges of sending a balloon aloft, keeping it in the air for 4 days, traveling thousands of miles. It's really an incredible technological feat that any of them actually arrived.
Uh-huh.
The vast majority of them failed due to any number of causes and went into the ocean never to be found. It should be noted, however, that about 30, maybe as many as 40, arrived here in Alaska. Most in western Alaska, most in the Bethel area, that's sort of where they were clustered,
uh-huh.
and out on the Aleutians. None of those caused any damage or any injuries or anything like that. But it's one of those interesting anecdotes of World War II that a lot of people don't even know about happened right in our backyard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I assume, obviously, there's probably some unexploded ordnance out there as a result of these being distributed the way that they were, but we'll probably... Hopefully that they're no longer live, and if someone finds one, it's not going to harm him or her.
Well, it's interesting you mention that. Just last October of 2014, there were two woodcutters in Lumbee, British Columbia, and they located one of the remains of a balloon bomb that had been on the ground for 70 years. Of course, most of the components had disintegrated, but the bombs were still there, easily identifiable. They called in the military, who brought in some C4, and they blew it all to smithereens. But the bomb was still there, and it looked pretty dangerous to me in the photographs.
Absolutely. I think in the context of other things that were done at the end of the Second World War, this is not as controversial as a lot of the other ones. That, you know, the current Prime Minister of Japan has been closely monitored for the things that he has to say about Japan's conduct during the war. This probably isn't going to come up in any of those conversations.
I seriously doubt it.
What's next for you in terms of research and publishing any new historical books that you're thinking about?
Well, I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I'm writing my dissertation right now about North Pacific salmon fisheries. This is in the late 19th, early 20th century. Specifically, I'm looking at scientific investigations of those fisheries. So some of the earliest, the first generation of salmon biologists, when they really didn't know anything about salmon, they didn't know how they spawned, they didn't know about returning to their birth streams, none of that. And so I'm writing a dissertation about those early scientists and the process of research that they went through to learn about salmon and then try and figure out how to regulate the fisheries for long-term sustainability.
Now, who was paying these early scientists? Was it the canneries and the fish companies in Seattle that owned all the canneries, or was there some other benefactor?
In some cases, it was. The U.S. Fisheries Bureau, which today we call the Fish and Wildlife Service, they funded some of this research, but, you know, the canneries, they felt that not enough research was being done. And so, in fact, the salmon packing industry contracted with scientists at the University of Washington, also at Stanford, and Scripps and Woods Hole and a few other institutions, and directly paid for the research, yes.
Right. And that, of course, might have had some interesting effects on its content. Well, we're about to wrap up here, Ross. When is your book signing? And you're also going to be speaking at the State Library. So.
Yes, I'm doing a lecture on Fugo, the Japanese balloons. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, at noon at the State Library. That's the 8th floor of the State Office Building. Then at 1:30, I'm doing a book signing at Hearthside here downtown.
Okay, great. And that's the old State Library off the atrium on the 8th floor of the State Office Building.
That's correct.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. Fugo is Ross Cohen's book, and you can hear him speak tomorrow at noon in the SOB, or you can go and get a copy of the book and have it signed at 1:30. Thanks again, Ross, and best of luck as you continue your researches and writing.
Thank you.
In 2013, biologists with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service fitted 50 red knots with radio transmitters. In spring, these sturdy sandpipers migrate through the vast waterland of the Copper River Delta in southeast Alaska. Researchers flying in small planes seek them out, listening intently for a signal. Tracking by transmitter and yellow leg flags has helped us learn a lot about the journeys of these long-distance migrants. We now know the vast majority of them on the Pacific coast rely on a very small number of places to rest and feed on their journey north from Mexico. Those locations are Willapa Bay and Grays Harbor in Washington State and the Copper River Delta in Alaska. Although on such long journeys the birds can't predict bad weather ahead, they can adapt. According to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, in 2010, a red knot equipped with a geolocator made a 600-mile detour to avoid exhausting headwinds. Another bird dodged a tropical storm by flying almost 2,500 miles around it. It's information about the precise movements of these birds that allows us to make informed choices about protecting the places they rely on most. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And we were looking at about 1 minute before the hour here, a Juno afternoon. Ben Brown here. It's been my pleasure to be your host this afternoon. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juno afternoon, Katie Bosler will be your host, and she'll be talking to David Bruce about this weekend's Amateur Radio Field Day. A Words 101 series will continue with Flip Todd of Todd Communications talking about publishing your own book. And Miles Gayton of the University of Alaska Southeast Class of 2015 will be here, along with the other normal features, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, all the other things you love to listen to on a Juno afternoon. The afternoon's weather going to this evening is mostly cloudy with lows 51 to 57. Thank you so much for listening and have a great afternoon.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on.